Welcome back to Living Art. Michael Woodson and Alex Tu doing an art show. Second segment, your community, local, free speech, non-mainstream art show. We're now turning to Brian Kenneth Swain, who has done a novel called Sestina. Brian has been on the KPFT board, and you're not in town anymore. You don't even live in Houston, right? So tell us a little bit about where you are now.
I was in Houston from 99 till about 3 years ago, and then for a variety of personal reasons, ended up in San Antonio. So I get back. I look for pretty much any excuse to get back to town. There's a pretty vibrant writing and literary and arts community here in town. So that's as good a reason as any to make the drive.
Anything else you want to say about your personal?
Only that I'm doing as much writing as I possibly can and fitting in between other things, and I'm it's kind of bouncing around between different things. I mean, this piece is a piece of fiction, and I write a fair bit of poetry and essays and all of that, and try to keep it mixed up. If I get hung up on one thing, I can always go off and work on some other project, right?
Right, and the contact information,
I've got a website out there with BrianKennethSwain.com, and most of the shorter stuff that I've written is actually on that site, except not the novels, of course, but a good chunk of the poetry and pretty much every essay and short story, even though I've published collections of those things, is actually sitting on that site as well. So that's my place for storing and kind of archiving everything that I've written.
Kenneth
Swain. Brian with an I. Kenneth Swain. SWAIN.com.
All right. Mm-hmm. So, listeners, if you want to check out his work, or even, I guess, buy the novel, start there. Sestina. Tell us about the novel.
Sestina is a reference to the Sistine Chapel in Rome. It is a in a nutshell, it's a religious thriller. It is involves lots of popes, friars, monks, people like that. Also, it spans a very wide time range. It actually starts at the time of the crucifixion and then advances rapidly up to the time of the Renaissance. About a third of the book takes place then with some action on the part of Michelangelo and other folks around that time. And then the second half of the book is in the present day. So it spans a couple of thousand years. Lots of ideas around challenging sort of standard accepted religious beliefs, right? So it's predicated on the idea that the resurrection story, as it's depicted in the Bible, happened a little differently, in fact, and that the different way in which it happened plays into the present day, and the church gets involved and so forth.
So there was no ascension.
That's the gist of the story. It's a little ambiguous as far as whether the actual resurrection took place, but the next part of the standard version of the story is crucifixion, burial, resurrection 3 days later, walks among people for 40 days or so, and then bodily ascends into heaven. And it's the last part of the story that I've let's just say taken some liberties with and built a fiction story out of. So it's a little
change. I don't need to give anything away, so you can slap me down at any moment. But the idea is that he never rose from the dead?
Not quite so much. It's left a little ambiguous whether the actual resurrection part took place. But it's because throughout the story, the primary thing that's happening is there is, in fact, this corporeal sort of body of Christ remaining here on earth, and there's this group of individuals who are charged with actually caring for this thing.
Right.
So you
Which
can debate
is the guild of the claw.
That's exactly right. So you can debate whether I kind of left it up in the air whether the resurrection took place and then he died again later, or the resurrection never took place to begin with. In either case, eventually you're left with a body, right?
That reminds me of Charlie Hebdo. And you're taking liberties with Christianity.
Yeah.
And if you think Have you ever gotten any hate mail?
Well, it's not. Let's just say that Dan Brown sold something like 80 million copies of Da Vinci Code. So when that happens, you're going to get some letters and some things. If I if the day comes when that's my biggest problem, then I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. But
you can get some protection, witness protection.
Yeah, exactly.
So what was it like? Do you feel like you took liberty with the facts of the Bible?
I don't know if it's so much liberty as, the opening of the book, the prologue, actually sort of fills in a scene that's absent. I mean, depending on which one of the Gospels you're looking at, it's fairly detailed up to the point of the crucifixion, right? And then he's dead, and you don't hear much after that until you get to the resurrection part, right?
I mean, one was clear, if I recall my theology, no one was really clear that Jesus was going to resurrect. I mean, no one suspected it, right?
Well, except his followers, of course, who that was what that was what their whole thing was predicated on. But the
I thought there was a lot of I thought the apostles were not even. They were confused by the idea of the resurrection.
Well, I mean, it was such an unprecedented thing that I suspect that the degree to which they actually believed this was going to happen varied from one person to another. But you have to believe they had a fairly good degree of faith that this was going to take place. Or why would they have made the sort of sacrifices they made? Right?
If the quote I remember is about the temple, that
correct.
The temple will be torn down and then rebuilt in 3 days,
exactly.
And no one. The apostles didn't know what that meant.
Right, it sounds very metaphorical.
Are there
right?
other references in the Bible that would suggest the idea of resurrection?
I think it was, and I'm certainly no theological scholar, but sure. I think it was referenced in a prophecy sort of way
in
multiple places. But the part that I sort of began taking some liberties with at the very beginning of the story was that section right from where they take him down from the cross and they prepare the body and they go through the burial process. There isn't any description in the Bible that I'm aware of that talks about that part of the story. And that's where they go through this thought process of and it kind of makes sense in a historical way. It's almost like, okay, many people have heard this prophecy, including the Romans, right? So the reason he was crucified in the first place was because the Romans felt threatened, different power structure and so forth and so on. So if they had any reason to believe that this resurrection had any chance of actually occurring, would they not have taken some steps to keep it from happening? And it's easy to imagine that they might have. And that was the debate that the apostles, as Joseph of Arimathea, Nicodemus, and some of the apostles went through at the beginning of the story, and they said, well, if we think there's some likelihood of that happening, then perhaps we'd better move the body and do something that people don't know about. Otherwise, whether or not we believe it would happen on its own, the last thing we want is for a bunch of centurions to show up and kind of mess up the whole thing, right?
And then it moves into the Renaissance?
Exactly.
And then to modern times.
The next thing you know, it's Michelangelo painting the Sistine Chapel ceiling. And what really sets the main brunt of the story in motion is in the present day, an earthquake takes place in Rome. And, of course, Italy has more than its share of earthquakes. And when that happens, a chunk of the ceiling, the plaster from the fresco actually falls down. And in the course of repairing that, that's when they discover there's this inscription actually hidden under the painting that alludes to where the body now is located, that this guild that you referred to earlier has been searching for a long time. So,
well, maybe we shouldn't pursue the plot any further.
No.
But jump forward. Having said that, I'll ask you to jump forward and place it in the modern plot, and then that'll do it for the plot.
Well, I mean,
you have the Renaissance, and now
the modern day part of the story, which is probably about half of the book, is essentially the earthquake happens, some pieces come down. One of the tourists who's in the chapel at the time of the earthquake actually steals some pieces of it and runs off with them, and it becomes this sort of race about, okay, we need the pieces that this fellow has stolen to help complete the message that we've discovered while we're trying to repair it. So it ends up involving the folks from the Vatican trying to solve this mystery, folks from this guild that you talked about trying to solve the mystery as well, because they've sort of lost track of where this body is, and now they think this is their big chance to to rediscover it. So that's the gist of the modern day part.
And that's where it's different from the Da Vinci Code.
The only similarity.
Neither one are in control, really.
That's exactly right. And I think if there's a similarity with that book, it's mainly the idea that there's this fundamental thing that has taken place that threatens one of the main theological underpinnings, if you like, of Christendom. That's the point of similarity.
We're talking to Brian Kenneth Swain, and he's the author of Sistina, which is just recently published. And what got you into writing in the first place?
I have probably been doing it off and on for a while, but seriously for about 10 years. And you know, you talk about every dark cloud having its silver lining. About 10 years ago, shortly after I got to Houston, I was working in a place that reorganized, and as a consequence, many people lost their jobs there, and I was one of them. And so I had a year or so of spare time on my hands, and guess what? I decided to take the opportunity to sit down and put together a couple of novels that had been noodling around in my head, and this isn't one of them. This came later, but that was the first real chance I had to spend some quality time actually writing.
Interesting. And what about the challenge of writing in this dialect or this language of religion? It seemed very stylized and formal, and I'm sure you knew that as you wrote it.
Yeah, it depends. It depends on what you're used to, I suppose. The one of the odd little side stories about this is the inscription that they actually find in the ceiling is this short sort of quasi-poetic thing that's actually written in Renaissance-era Latin. And so needless to say, I don't know anything about Latin, Renaissance or otherwise. And so I had to poke around and find an expert who could supply that translation in an authentic period way, and there just happened to be a fellow at UT San Antonio who's a classics professor who was happy to contribute some expertise in that.
And the dialogue is between priest and educated kind of formal voices.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, there are a lot of interesting characters in the story. Many of them are clergy. There's cardinals and popes and monks and all of that sort of thing. And there are also scientific experts that they call in to actually do this repair on the ceiling. And so the conversations that you end up with between these very lay, skeptical, academic type of people and these, you know, very Vatican indoctrinated types of people, needless to say, it's a strained
Was that hard to shift tone?
It basically just involves reading a lot of other things that people on both sides of that divide have done and trying to get a tone, get a sense for their voice and how they would communicate. The part that you really can't foresee, I guess, is how they. It's easier to figure out how they carry on normal conversations, but when you put two such different types of people together, and now you say, well, how are they gonna? How are they going to carry on? So you've got this, for example, this female academic from Harvard who's a fresco expert, who lives and breathes art history, talking to this cardinal from the Vatican who isn't comfortable with many facets of her being there trying to do this job, and they have some, let's just say, they have some awkward moments.
That's fun to write that kind of tone.
It is.
Okay, we should wrap up, but tell us something in closing.
The story has a couple of open ends that lend itself to going off in future directions, and it's been suggested by more than one person that I ought to have a go at that. But there are other things, you know, and this whole notion of playing with religious themes for fiction is something that fascinates me a lot. In fact, I've got the next novel after this is already written and sitting in a binder on a shelf, kind of waiting its turn. And actually, in a way, it's more timely now because that next story involves the Temple Mount in Jerusalem and three family stories, a Christian family, a Jewish family, and a Muslim family trying to work together to avert something really bad happening on the Temple Mount. So there's a lot of publicity. On any given day, that little 37-acre piece of real estate is probably the most contentious place on earth, and it makes for some good nonfiction, much less actual fiction. But that one's kind of waiting in the waiting in the wings. So that the using religious and theological themes to write fiction is turning out to be pretty interesting.
Nice. Glad you are enjoying it. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that does it for this segment. We'll be back to talk about